Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to Stop and Search. This is Breaking the News Part 2. And yep, we're on Scroobius Pips Distraction Pieces Network, in our Discord, in association with Lit UK, Butcher by Acast. Here we go. Behind your barricade. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricade. Where to balance on the street? Thank you so much for joining us again, and as I said, this is Breaking the News Part 2. Breaking the News Part 1 will be scrolling as I'm rambling on right now, so go and listen to that if you're not already. Just to remind you, our guests are Felicity Morse, who at the time was with the iNews, but now she's a freelance consultant on social media, life coaching, you name it, she does it. So thank you so much, Felicity, for joining us. We've had such feedback to Felicity's input on this as well. Everybody's saying she's completely captivating, and I tend to agree with that. We've also got Tiernan Duyeb, who I can actually say his name now, which it took me so long to do, and I was so nervous about saying it. And as Tiernan points out, Google, it corrects everything. So put in Tiernan Duyeb into Google and find his Partly Political broadcast, which is just a brilliant podcast. I really do recommend it. It's funny, it's informative. He has amazing guests on there. Also, Andrew Doyle, who you would know from a co-writer from the Jonathan Pye character, a comedian, stand-up, playwright, writer, author now. You name it, Andrew's done it. So thank you so much, guys, for joining us. And just a quick unusual shout-out to make, which we try and keep these intros quite short, but on this one, there's a bit of an unusual happening, which it kind of dovetails into what the subject matter is about in this particular podcast episode. So we're talking about social media, we're talking about mainstream media, how it integrates, what the swell is between the two. Well, last month, just before Christmas in November, just in case you didn't know when Christmas was, we had quite a happening because of one of our supporters, followers, listeners. Thank you so much to Pablo Diablo, who is a friend of ours now, because he's, goodness knows, he's done well for us. He ended up calling in to talk radio, because as you may know, if you're a UK listener, Ian Lee was on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and our friend Rufus Hound took over his talk radio show for about a couple of weeks. So our friend Pablo Diablo, he ended up calling in and raising the subject of the war on drugs, and happened to mention us. Said that he was a listener of our podcast, and because Rufus is a former guest, I had a bit of a chat on there. Next thing you know, Pablo's only gone and arranged one of our speakers, Annie Michon, to have a complete hour-long episode with Rufus in the studio. That is just fantastic. We can't thank you enough for that, Pablo. And that's exactly everything that we've been saying in this podcast and across our channels in general, is, you know, don't just agree with us. Support us, help us, get us out there. You use our work as a gateway into a conversation. And that's exactly what Pablo did. And just out of courtesy, because it's just, you know, we can't thank him enough. If you go to Food to Watch Films By podcast, which I've been listening to, on Twitter, I'm just looking at it as we speak now, at FTWFB podcast. To repeat that, that's at FTWFB podcast. Please do subscribe, because it's just the least you can do to thank Pablo for helping us out. So on that note, now that I put the pressure on you to actually use this podcast for more than just listening, let's get on with this episode. Don't forget, this is Breaking News Part 2 on Stop and Search, and you know the rest. Here we go. Going back to what you were saying, Andrew, of how satire has kind of evolved, and in the time that you've been doing comedy, has there been much evolution in the way that you write and deliver satire? I mean, we've always had things, examples like Have I Got News For You, Mock the Week, and things like that. Is it getting more popular? Is it getting less popular, do you know?
I think satire generally is less common. So if you take something like Brass Eye, which was Chris Morris's program, that which couldn't, I don't believe, could be made today. I don't think it would be made today. It's because television's too risk-averse.
I liked that. What do you mean it's too risk-averse?
I would suggest to you that a number of the topics that Chris Morris broached, a commissioner wouldn't even go there, because they would say, because they need a guarantee that this is going to be popular before it's going to be good. So the popularity exceeds quality in terms of what they're doing, whereas, of course, Chris Morris is the master at what he did. I don't think there's been anything really as successful satirically since then. Maybe South Park would be an example. And I think part of the reason for that is that there's too much of a consensus in terms of opinion amongst satirists or comedians. I think that there's too much of a one-sided view on these things. I mean, Brexit would be a perfect example, wouldn't it? Because straight after Brexit, every comedian was making really lazy jokes about Brexit voters being racist and stupid, stuff that just isn't true. And it became kind of a way to signal that you were good. You know, whereas with satire, I'm much more interested in saying the things that we're not all thinking, or that people aren't generally thinking. And of course, satire can't do that if everyone is thinking the same way, or if only one perspective is perceived as acceptable and anything that's alternative is perceived as evil, which I think is what's happening at the moment, because we're getting more of a polarization of politics. So, you know, left is going left, further left is now mainstream, and further right is now mainstream, and therefore we don't get that sort of area in the middle, which is the interesting area, I think.
I mean, my favourite thing is that everybody is the underdog at the moment.
Yeah.
I just think it's fascinating.
Everyone wants to be the victim.
Yeah.
Everyone does, you know, and this is a real problem.
Yeah, it's like there's a power in it.
Yeah.
And yet, victim and not vulnerable.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah, it's vulnerability. But I'm on this big crusade about vulnerability being like the most powerful thing at the moment, because I just think, you know, there's such power in rolling over, because nobody thinks that's what you're going to do.
That makes it quite hard for me, because comedy, essentially, or, you know, the idea of comedy is that you're punching up rather than punching down. But if everybody's the victim, then you're always punching down, no matter who you're punching at, I guess.
Yeah. When you were talking about comedy as well, I thought it was really interesting, because one of my friends is like a spoken word poet, and he did a performance somewhere, and the guy was used to hosting comedy, and he did his poem, and a guy came running around just to check if he was okay, because it was like deadly silence, and he was like, no, that's exactly the response that I want.
Yeah.
And he was like, you know, that, like, that's terrible, like that would be my worst nightmare.
That goes back to saying podcast boss Scribius Pip, he interviewed Eddie Izzard this week, and Eddie Izzard said that on stage when he's doing comedy, you know, that powerful laugh is what he wants, but then when he's doing drama, he wants that palpable silence, and some people find that difficult to handle. And that's something, strangely enough, I don't know how I'm managing to link this, but that's something that we do in job policy, isn't it? When you're giving presentations, I managed it, kind of tenuous, but got there. But when you're doing presentations, I've been in the room when you have just created that, not a tumbleweed moment, but that complete silence, just that every eye pointed at you, every ear open. So you've had that experience of controlling palpable silence. What is that like?
You mean when I died? I do try and play with some people's emotions when I speak, because it's some emotional stuff, emotional stories that I'm telling, and you know, I want people to empathise in the same ways that I used to empathise. So yeah, I mean, it's taken a little bit of practice to do that, but yeah, I mean, I do, you know, that silence, that deathly silence and slightly wide-eyed looks is what I'm after. Yeah, but
because if you've not read Neil's book, Good Cop, Bad War, then I recommend it's in all good and bad bookshops, I suppose. But and it was in Beijing as well. Someone sent me a picture in Beijing holding the book, so it's out there as well, which is, you know, just incredible. And Singapore, I think, strangely, which, yeah. So, yeah, if you know anything about drug policy, Singapore. Anyway, we don't talk about drug policy, do we? That's too much. But I'm going to give you the badge test in a minute, because Tiernan was coveting my school badge here. I'm going to just briefly touch on drug policy, because Felicity, you put something on your Facebook the other day that was quite interesting about someone that suffered, or the widespread problem of porn addiction right now.
Yeah.
And this is something that Marcus Brigstock was talking to us about. He was very open about the fact that, you know, he's dealt with a lot of addictions and he's decided to cut porn out of his life. And this is something that, we're just not really addressing in society, is these third rail issues of how they're affecting people. And addiction being just this whole giant holistic picture, as opposed to being good and evil, illegal, bad. And this is what, you know, again, these moral panics that we have. Do you think that we are purposely pushing certain subjects like that, like porn addiction, to the side when we should be addressing them more?
Yeah, and I suppose this is where it comes to vulnerability again, right? Because, you know, I've been commissioning a lot of stuff around porn actually at the moment, and it's a real interesting one. People don't share it, and they do. I have had some people share their experiences, like in my inbox. I've gone out with people who've had, like, or have felt they've been addicted to porn in a way that it has felt very difficult for them, and so I have an awful lot of empathy there. And yeah, I don't know what my point was really, other than, like, it doesn't have to look passed out on the street to be causing someone pain. I mean, I suppose we all know that, but it's just, and I mean, I suppose the problem is that nobody really wants to talk about masturbation. So here I am talking about it. There we go.
I was going to say, is there something in the, because not just porn, but the whole kind of being on your phones, kind of always getting a hit of something, seems to be a general addiction in society at the moment. People just needing to see something, get that kind of hit of news or porn video, whatever it is, at all times. And I find it really depressing. Like, kind of every now and then, I just want to look at the sea for a bit. It's quite nice, you know. And I feel that that's kind of, it just feels everyone's very self-absorbed and very in the need for their own kind of gratification at all times. Which, I mean, is big talk from a comedian who needs laughs, but, you know, it's...
You can see how problems start to invade comedians' lives, because you're out there travelling the country and the world, getting those big hits and those big endorphin rushes off a crowd, and then all of a sudden you're in a hotel room on your own. That must be a nightmare to deal with.
Two Saturdays ago I performed to just under 2,000 people and then drove on the M4 home and stopped in Leigh Delamere Station and had a Starbucks. And you go, oh, this is a bit shit. Yeah. It is weird. It's very weird.
So is it a lifestyle, Andrew, that you can imagine that traps start to come in inherently within that occupation?
Well, being a stand-up? I think the occupation is a trap, I think, in many ways. No, it is. It's a bizarre, self-destructive way to make a living, because it is, as you say, it's narcissistic, essentially, but it's also self-hating, or it is from my perspective, anyway, because you put yourself in such a vulnerable position in terms of your ego, anyway, don't you? Because the laughter, it's great, you get those endorphins and all the rest of it, and then when it doesn't quite work, it's crushing, you know, so you have both sides of that. It's not something I'd recommend... generally.
Hugely antisocial hours.
Massively, yeah.
Massively antisocial hours. You're constantly offered, like, free beer and stuff at gigs, which is terrible if you're trying not to drink and things like that. You know, your whole health... I mean, my health is terrible, primarily because of eating at weird hours and, you know... It's
at least you're not stuck in front of a computer, though. Poor victim me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'll have you know, I sit in front of a computer all day before I go outside and eat unhealthily.
Are we back to the porn addiction again, Tiernan?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying I'm a victim, because I've done it myself. I've chosen to do this, you know, and I just think it's... And it can be really great, like, sometimes. But I'm really interested in, though, what you say about, like, particularly what you were saying about social media and about the way in which people need... I suppose it's a need for validation. which might link into what you were saying about clickbait. Like, so, because when things are retweeted, you feel...
Yeah, I mean, they do it on purpose, though. They've got a name for it. It's called gamification, which I said... Oh, I swore at the first time somebody said that because I had no patience for it. I was like, just tell me what's going on. But, they're, you know, it's meant to be addictive. Like, you start and you're like, right, I'm going to edit my own story. You know, you've got your bio there. You know, you've got your handle, you've got your picture. You choose it all. You're invested in it. And then you build up your own story, choosing what you want to write, what you want to say, and yeah, how many followers do you have? You get a little heart. You know, it's the equivalent for like, you used to get a little bit of a buzz when phones came out and you got that little envelope, you know, when phone screens were still green and you're like, I've got a text. And it's the same now, but they are addictive. Like they are because I've had actually really big issues with it this year, where I was just getting so addicted to Twitter. And when you're doing it for work as well, I was like, oh, just like must stay on top of the news. So I was like, not even like reading articles, I was like just like screenshotting stories and just be like, come back to that later. I've got like reams and reams in my phone roll of just like stories. I mean, like, it's just mad. And then and I go around in circles, so do like Twitter, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, Instagram. Oh, let's check the other one again. Let's check, like, go around again. Okay.
There's a program you can get to block all that if you need to do work. There's a program, so like, for 3 hours, I just want to work and not do that cycle of checking every social media outlet you've got. I mean, I came off Facebook for the month of the Edinburgh Festival. It was brilliant. It was so liberating. It is like an addiction, because the first few days I was like, I went to check it. I was like, no, I'm not on it. And then you start to feel slightly more liberated, and it's really nice.
Is it an occupational hazard of you guys that?
Yeah.
That being in that social media loop, but you know, because you have to be quite current,
have to be on it. Like I missed gig offers by not being on Facebook for the month, right? Stuff like that. So because then I had messages, phone messages, which was bizarre, saying, "Well, I've tried to get you on Facebook. What's going on?" And you also feel like you need to be tweeting regularly because it does help sell tickets and things, you know. So you do feel obliged to be on it. But just to fit in with what you were saying about the way you put your Facebook page up, I mean, you are commodifying yourself. You're putting a product out there, even if you're not in the entertainment industry. It is a product because you only show the things about yourself that you would like people to believe about you. So, of course, that's dispiriting when people don't like it, you know, when people don't come back and give you good feedback.
Especially you, Ian, and with being a podcast, having to push it out there yourself, because you're not getting any help in doing that. You've got to do it. So it must be difficult to try and get away from the social media.
If I didn't have stuff to promote, I don't think I'd like to believe I'm not on it. I'd definitely be on it, but I'd like to believe I wouldn't be on it. But like, just because all I have to do is I'm gigging here, check this out, listen to the podcast, and the main way to get, you know, I've found Twitter incredibly useful. I mean, I've got, you know, an all right amount of followers despite not really doing TV or anything, and I've found that those people then do come to shows, and then those people listen to a podcast, and they tell other people to listen to podcasts, and then they come to shows. So it is a self-generating kind of PR machine, which is wonderful, but it's really exhausting, and it's relentless, you know. But I don't know. I think especially in the world where there's too much content, there's so much content, trying to get people to notice yours is very hard work. And I still don't really know how you do that. There's probably a secret somewhere, but I don't know. Yeah,
I just want to quickly touch upon, slightly linked into that, how the advent of social media has created characters, and quite big characters at that. There's a great article in Vice from about 3 or 4 years ago called The Dangers of Obverse Journalism, which is basically how journalism doesn't necessarily give balance anymore, because the prime example they use is Katie Hopkins. So if you're looking for a subject matter to get two experts on, drug policy being a good example, drug policy tends to be very weighted in our favour. There's not many people that are experts that are willing to say that we shouldn't have drug policy reform. So when you seek out somebody to give the opposing side of saying, no, we should keep the laws strict and harsh and we shouldn't do this, counter to our position, that can be against the balance, because you're not representing the scale of what way the opinion is. Is there a danger in social media when we're creating these experts that we are not giving the right amount of balance to certain key subjects like drug policy, certain other third rail topics as well?
I could say so much about this.
In a good way, do I need to hide?
No, it's fine. I mean, like, for example, the Tories at the last election wouldn't put anybody up for any debates because they thought that would stop the BBC from having the discussion because they couldn't have balance and, like, it was a challenge. And then you have things like... And then you have this interesting thing around shame. So I wrote this article on abortions and having an abortion because... because you would have these ridiculously polarised discussions and nobody would... There was nobody willing to, like, actually talk about it. So just sort of having these theoretical debates. I mean, it can go the other way and then somebody can have too much... say because they had that experience, not too much say, but they can have an awful lot say because they had the experience and, like, they don't speak for everybody. So that could be something the other way. And then you just have, like, the polarised thing. So I was going to say go on a show to talk about not minding wolf whistling. And the other person was, like, somebody who had been sexually attacked. And I was like, well, I'm not saying it's one or the other. You know,
it's that climate change thing, isn't it? Because it's always with climate change. It's like it's 98.9% of scientists say climate change is a problem. We should, but every time it's on a TV program, there's an expert on climate change and someone who says it's definitely not happening. And you sort of go, this isn't really the right ratio. Like, you should really have 100 people who say it's happening, and then this guy who keeps walking into a glass wall because he doesn't believe it's there. You know, that would be a more correct balance. But it's very odd.
We have that trouble, don't we? It's not balanced. There's a lot on our side of drug policy reform, and there's not a lot over on the other side. And sometimes you can create the danger of the illusion of balance when there isn't there to begin with.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's always a massive bugbear. Whenever the BBC want to interview one of us, they always dig up some shouty person for balance, and they're not offering any evidence. That's the thing. We're offering evidence, but there's no evidence to counter it. So that's not really balanced debate, because there is no debate. It's just someone spouting things that are clearly not true or making ad hominem attacks. So, yeah.
Is that not because they want that? They want a sparky debate that's entertaining, that people will watch and retweet? Because, well, you can always find someone who has some moderate voice, really, if you look hard enough, I would have thought.
Yeah, well, possibly. But I think with the BBC case, it's just their rules, because I've discussed it with so many of them and the producers before the show, and they say, no, this they're not thinking with an entertainment hat on. They're thinking with following the BBC rules.
I think
rules.
It's a poor interpretation of their rules. I agree, it's their
and that,
rules.
That's exactly the discussion I have with them.
That's what they want, really. But then, like, these people... Then you have the other thing where these opposing people, and I think we had this... I think you had this on Good Morning Britain the other week, where these people are brought on just so somebody who are so clearly wrong, just so the presenter can then look very good by taking them down. And it's like, well, this undermines everybody. I feel undermined watching this guy being publicly humiliated on...
You mean the gay therapy?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Like, yeah. Obviously this guy is wrong. Obviously it's terrible. But, like, you know, you just brought on an idiot to call him an idiot.
Yeah,
like, well,
it's like
done.
The X Factor auditions or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It gives them publicity because they're kind of given a platform.
And then, I mean, I suppose you run the risk of then feeling sorry for that person, or just like, anyway, that was a total waste of time. Like, you know, why?
I was going to say, is any part of that the fact that we have to fill, like, there's so much content to fill now as well? Like, I kind of feel like with 24-hour news, sometimes you sort of go, we don't need the news on now. Like, nothing's happened for 3 hours. No one really cares.
Oh,
especially
no,
when there's like a royal birth
stuff happening
or something, and there's just people outside going, nothing's happened yet. And you're like, well, you don't need to tell us. Just wait until something happens.
No, I think there's loads going on. There's always loads to discuss. I think there is a slight willy-waving problem with the media. I'm sorry. I'm being really mean about penises, but everybody thinks, oh, that person is doing that, therefore I must do that, therefore this must do, you know, everybody sort of copies each other. Oh, they've got that on their front page, why don't we have that at all? And people don't read news like that on the internet anyway. Like, news doesn't occur in a vacuum in the same way as you buy one paper. And, you know, if people spent a little bit less time just constantly replicating stuff, we'd have an awful lot more interesting information.
Sure. Yeah, makes sense.
So is the line being blurred between news and entertainment too much now?
It's always been blurred between news and entertainment. I just think it's become more obvious because of this popularity aspect of it. Like, you know, that you were always going to get entertainment probably to sell. There'd probably be one interview that would sell the paper. And you get all the other stuff in. It's just you need more of that stuff and you're losing less of the, I suppose, serious stuff because people were never reading it. It's just now we have the data, you know? And then I was speaking to somebody who was like, well, we will commission this stuff, but nobody will read it. But we feel we have to commission it. And it's like, well, that's no good either. Because well done for paying the journalist, but if nobody's reading it, like, what's the point? You have to get really skilled at getting people to read it. That's the point. If you can't get people to read it, like, you know, you put it on your homepage for all you want, but it's only there to make you feel good.
Mm. All right, I'm going to go in with the million-dollar question now, and again, you don't feel you have to give any kind of coherent argument to this, but I'm going to start you first here, and what is your opinion on drug policy?
My opinion on drug policy, the limited knowledge that I have of it.
Bearing in mind there's a badge in it for
oh
you.
Oh, God, I really want the badge. It's like it's from a tiny policeman. what happened? He's so small. So, I don't know. I've always thought that it's always, as we discussed, the kind of fear and outrage. There is one death from one drug and suddenly that becomes a thing that all of those are bad and that one particular drug is bad rather than perhaps something else happened or, you know, it's not that... I haven't done drugs in quite some time. I used to a bit. I had a lovely time. I generally sort of realised that a lot of people are careful, a lot of people... I think, if anything, if there was more regulation and there were safer ways to do it, then I don't see why there's such a problem about it. I think sometimes that the headlines to make people scared about it are just because that feeds people's want for them to be bad, you know? Several years ago, 2001, I went to a big rave in the Czech Republic and they had a pill testing tent there. And everyone would go to the rave with their drugs and they'd take it into a tent and somebody would scrape the little pill and go, do you know what? That one's great. Have a lovely time. Or, oh God, don't take that. It's terrible. And nobody died. Everyone had an amazing weekend. And you sort of go, why don't we do that here? Like, that's so sensible. That's not stopping anyone from having the weekend they want to have. It's, you know, it just, why can't we have more sensible implements like that? That's my limited knowledge on it, but that's how I feel about it.
I think that deserves a badge, don't you?
Yeah. Yes,
and a round
that's all
of applause,
I
think. There you go.
Thanks very much.
And I think Henry's left now, but Henry is one of the chief scientists that does actually do pill testing. They've gone across with the loop, the festivals all of this year. Most festivals, there's been a few that they've not been allowed at. And they found some weird stuff in there in the drugs testing.
Yeah, anti-malaria tablets sold as crushed up and sold as cocaine. Yeah, there's powdered concrete in something else. It's not something you want to be snorting, really.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So, again, I'm going to put you on the spot. Andrew, there is a badge.
Is it the same question?
Yeah. Again, you don't have to come up with anything that, you know...
I'll preface it by saying that I'm open to persuasion, but my feeling about it is that I would be probably for a wholesale decriminalisation across the board. The reason being that I think we could learn a lot from prohibition, because after prohibition, the gangs had no power whatsoever and they were wiped out. I think you'd wipe out an entire criminal industry, my instinct suggests. I think overnight, like these people would have another. And these are people targeting kids, targeting vulnerable people, sophisticating the drugs with unpleasant substances, with dangerous substances. I mean, all of this, I think, would go, and then it would be down to the individual to choose what to put into their own body. And I would suggest that's a better situation than what we have. So if you know it's a self-destructive thing, we do it anyway with alcohol, don't we? But you want to do that to your own body, you should be allowed to do that, I think.
Well, I think that deserves a badge as well.
That was a good answer. That was very good.
Yeah, I think we'd agree with that, wouldn't you, Neil?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely right about the criminal networks. Definitely.
Neil's the guy to speak to about the criminal networks. Being a former undercover, I'm pretty sure that you've got lots of tales yet to still tell on just how bad it is out there, really. And Felicity, do I put you on the spot?
Well, I think you were saying that you're the expert, is that right?
Yeah, I
don't know.
I was gonna say I'm not.
Well, I really don't know enough, to be honest. I know that I massively abuse alcohol, nicotine, caffeine. Are there any others that are legal? Anything on prescription, I'll take. Yeah, mostly. If it doesn't interact with the other ones.
We won't judge if it's illegal.
No, no. So amnesty here. You know, bring it all out to the forum.
Amnesty on this recorded podcast that will be available to the public.
I think things start to go wrong when there's a mix, isn't there? Because you need to look at what is rather than what you would like it to be, right? That's how you should treat the world. So you do what is best for the way humans are rather than the way that you would want them to be, I think.
So would you be open to looking at the evidence and deciding from there?
Yeah, I think you have to look at what is least harmful. Really?
See, that's harm reduction, isn't it? That's something that we completely subscribe to. Always go for the lowest common denominator in harm, and chances are you've got the right policy. So I think that's an open-minded badge, don't you? Yeah? Go on, then. I think we can do that.
Thank you.
So have we got questions from the audience? There must be at least one that we can field. So, there we go. Well done. Thank you for that. What's your name?
Hi. So I'm just trying to find the words to sort of articulate this properly, but a couple of really interesting points were brought up earlier. First one that springs to mind is the sort of different channels that we use, you know, saying that the audio stuff, generally is less powerful than the written word or visual media, possibly due to the way that we're generally wired as human beings. And clearly, you know, within the media, there are political agendas that need to be pushed or want to be pushed by different publications. Do you think there is any kind of correlation between, not so much the political side of things, but do you think that there is a sort of curated way that different publications will give different people or different topics certain channels only to communicate through because they know that will either inhibit or promote, you know, a certain type of discussion or a certain type of reach for the topic, if you like. And why do you think it's that way, and how do you think it might change in the future?
Do you mean like sort of how the Alex Jones InfoWars kind of thing is just specifically on YouTube?
Yeah, like, so, I mean, okay, case in point here, the discussion we're having tonight, it's going to be on a podcast. It's happening in real life. It's going to be published on a podcast. Chances are you wouldn't have as balanced and open-minded a discussion on, say, a YouTube channel or certainly a television show. You might on a radio panel discussion, but why is that? Is it just political? Is it just to, you know, limit? Is that because that's just, you know, that's what society is comfortable with and no one's challenging it enough? Or is there sort of a more sinister reason behind it? I genuinely have no opinion. I'm just interested.
I don't think there's any agendas. I think it's just the way that we are. Like, you know, we feel freer when it's a smaller group of people. Mm-hmm. I think, and also, other thing, I don't think audio is less powerful. I think it is just harder to make it go viral.
But why? Surely it means that it's being had less attention paid to it than more visual or...
No, it's not. I mean, like, it's not. I mean, you'll find there'll be loads of... there'll be a huge amount of, like, Radio 2 listeners, you know? So it's very popular on radio. It's just not... The internet doesn't like it as much. And I imagine that's because of the way people use the internet.
It's not. I suppose it's not very interesting to kind of stare at a computer and click on audio and do nothing else. Is it, you know, you kind of...
I think it's also because of sharing. So when you're sharing, you're saying, like, it's like, look at this, or something like that. You know, even with, like, long articles, people just clip the bit they like. And then... and YouTube doesn't really share that well to Twitter or Facebook, but that's because of algorithmic reasons. I mean, there's all sorts of things at play here. Like, all sorts. Like, say, for example, the reason Facebook likes video is because you can put adverts in front of it, which cost more money on a video than they do on, what is it, words, right, articles, yeah. Text.
So also, there also must be a kind of, is there an age factor, kind of who uses what, and so what's targeted at each age range? I'm asking that as a question from someone
who
hasn't got a
clue, there's trends as well, and I was going to bring this up earlier. Like, younger people have tend to have much smaller social networks and are much more into chat apps than maybe our generation, because, like, they talk to each other that way.
And so more WhatsApp and things like that rather than
Snapchat,
Facebook,
WhatsApp, and, you know. Yeah, messengers.
Cool.
Is that sort of half answered it?
Yeah, no, it's fine. To be honest, I don't really know what an answer would be that would satisfy.
Well, I find it really interesting. Like, what I find amazing about Jonathan Bye is that, because you mainly do it on YouTube, don't you?
Or no, Facebook.
Oh, is it Facebook?
Yeah.
Oh, because I found out about it through YouTube. Right, yeah, because that's interesting. Because I found that I originally started my podcast on YouTube, but I found it very hard to make people sit and watch it in one go. I'd get people kind of go, they'd watch the first few minutes and they'd come back to it. Whereas I find, as we talked about earlier, a podcast people invest in and they go, right, I'm going to listen to this now. This is my journey to work. It will be my company. So I found YouTube a much harder method to get people's attention. But then, as I was sort of mentioned earlier, that there's a lot of kind of right-wing press in the US that's doing incredibly well via YouTube. But maybe that's because of its kind of direct talking at people attitude. I don't know what it is that works like that.
It's because of the algorithms on Facebook. It comes up on people's news feeds if they think that you will be interested or if people you like have liked it and all that sort of thing. So it's much, much easier to share things through Facebook.
I guess, sorry, just one last... I feel like this might be a bit of a moot red herring point here, but, like...
Pitch it.
Okay, so you're saying audio is not as powerful, right?
No, I said it's not. It's harder to make it go viral.
Sorry, you're saying it's not as powerful. Right, okay, so...
It's harder to make it go viral. The internet likes it less. Social media is harder to share. Sorry, I'm being really... I'm just not controlling my tone well. But it's just much harder to share it.
Problems with audio.
It's just much harder to...
Okay. Right.
I write for a living.
Yeah, no, it's fine. But, like... Okay, so Phone Jack of the TV show, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in its original format. Would that have been as popular as it was if it didn't have the visual element attached to it and it was just an audio? Because arguably that's where the content is, right? That it's the sounds that he's making. It's the impression.
You get so many TV shows started out as, or so many, maybe not so much now, but there were a lot of TV shows that you start out as radio shows, got popular on radio, and then would go to TV to reach a much wider audience. So like Mighty Boosh started out as a radio show, League of Gentlemen. So it's almost as if you kind of go, well, this smaller group will like it. I think it's, yeah. I wonder if it's just knowing where the audience is. and how to reach people.
I think it's really interesting because I think with the advent of podcasts and you're saying, you know, like generational preferences and things like that, will more audio forms of media, whether they be podcasts or radio shows or, you know, whatever else comes, will they sort of gain traction, become more popular as people, you know, the younger generations get older? Do you think then that will change the sort of dynamic of how media is?
Yeah, the one major difference, there's a lot of similarities between print and online media. The one major difference that we have online is this concept of peer-reviewed news, which is basically like, it's basically like the popular comes to the top. You know, you would never see that, the most read. So you click on it just because it's most read. You know, you just want to look at what other people are looking at. Mm-hmm. It's a weird phenomenon that...
I think that's a real danger, actually, that the thing about algorithms and about most read. And I think I'm particularly worried about YouTube and Google and Facebook. I mean, these people are open about their discriminatory practices. So you'll find on YouTube recently lots of Republican or right-wing people have been demonetized and seen their videos demonetized because their political view doesn't fall in line with Silicon Valley. People like Diamond and Silk, for instance, who are pro-Trump, but they never swear. There's nothing offensive about anything they say. They're just pro-Trump. Most of their videos have been demonetized by YouTube, and therefore they won't be popping up all the time. People won't be seeing these videos very often, and what you end up with is an echo chamber. You end up with everyone who goes to YouTube or Google or Facebook. I mean, Zuckerberg was caught on a hot mic saying something to Angela Merkel about this, about we're going to make certain points of view aren't seen. He did say this. Now, this what will happen is you'll have to end up with other platforms springing up, and then you'll get more polarization. You know, everyone on the liberal left will go to YouTube, and everyone on the right will go over here. And because everyone on the right is called a Nazi by the liberal left, even though they're not, they're going to get more resentful and go over there. I think this is a real, real problem. So I think maybe more channels, more alternative platforms, maybe podcasts, maybe audio, whatever, will have to spring up to combat what is effectively a form of stealthy censorship.
Well, there's also a thing with YouTube, like whatever your video is. I found this last time, ages ago, and tried to post a video. If you want it to appear in the sidebar of any other video, you've now got to pay for that. It doesn't appear automatically, unless you've got very good tags or something. It will appear a lot less than it used to. There was a point where anyone could put anything on YouTube and it would appear on the front page and do everything, and now you have to pay for Google Ads in order to get it noticed, and that's quite bad. Whereas, I mean, the joy of podcasting is anyone could
do. Do you not think you should have to pay for that? I mean, somebody's got to pay for it.
But the more payment there is, then the more scope there is for people pushing external agendas through those fora, no?
Well, if you're not willing to pay for it, somebody has to pay for it.
But then YouTube also earn money from the adverts that they put in front of the videos anyway.
Do you know how much? Like, Google might make something off it, but, like, nobody's making any money off it.
I think they're doing all right, though, aren't they, Google?
Yeah, I think
I've heard they're all right. Yeah.
I think Google are.
But they own YouTube, don't they?
Yeah, that's why Facebook doesn't like it.
Okay.
It's all getting very. It sort of reminds me of like the Greek gods or something. You know.
I love the Greek gods.
Yeah.
Bring them back.
That's got very sophisticated, isn't it? We never have this kind of sophistication on it. Right, anybody else got a question? This is a great one down there. Thank you for that. There must be someone else. Come on. Here we go. Well done at the back there.
Hi, my name's Ryan. I guess I've really appreciated all of what you've contributed and talked about this evening. My question is how much time you spend thinking about how do I reach my audience versus how much you spend on what the platforms want you to do in order to satisfy the algorithm of where they want the audience to go. And how much do you create the content knowing where that audience is today versus where the audience is going to be? So, for example, you know, Facebook wants to become a TV channel. They're underpricing ads for video. So if you create rich media video captioned, you'll have far more reach than if you just do text and copy. Does that come into your own equations for your own causes, news channel, comedy?
I mean, you've hit on an age-old question in terms of art generally, and so comedians, for instance, it depends what type of comedian you want to be. If you want to say things, for instance, if I decided tomorrow I'm going to just do jokes about Jeremy Corbyn and but how great Nigel Farage is and brilliant Nigel. I know that I'm committing career suicide there. I know that that's happening. So I think for me, luckily I don't have that view, you know, but for me, it's just I think just do what you want to do creatively and see which way the wind falls, and that's always been my approach, rather than trying to anticipate what the zeitgeist is going to be. But you're absolutely right. There's commercial concerns with everything you do. So I suppose it's a balance, really. I mean, I'll give you an example of the video I mentioned earlier. I won't keep going on about it, but the Trump video we did, because it was attacking the left. It was saying the left got it wrong, and that's why Trump won. That was the thrust of this video that went viral in America. Tom and I said to each other after we'd written it, I promise you, we said, this is going nowhere. No one's going to share this. And this was the one, like 140 million or whatever. Like, so that's the difference, right? We did not... We just did what we wanted to do, and that happened to work. And I think that if I, as a stand-up, for instance, if I go out of my way to just try and appeal and be popular, I reckon the quality would be diminished, I think. And then maybe it wouldn't do as well anyway. Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know.
Well, also, I think you have more competition if you try and be popular because everybody's trying to be popular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another thing.
Yeah.
Fuck the algorithm, that's what I say. Like, social media is, like, made up of people. If you're trying to talk to people, try and do that as effectively as possible.
Yeah. No, I think I'd make what you want to make. I mean, the only... I don't know if that counts in your question. Like, I spent far too long yesterday trying to add tags to my podcast so that it might be found in searches. But there's things like that that I try and be aware of that I'm not very good at. There's a thing that I've started doing, titling your podcast, so people might... I used to just write episode 72 or whatever, and now I have to write, like, what this week is Boris is Boris or whatever, you know, in some sort of... You kind of hope that it might be more appealing to the eye, but that doesn't mean its content is in any way changed to... work for a different... Like, I've made the content I want to make, but it's about labelling it. I try and spend some time in making sure that I can get people to see it, but I don't... I haven't got a clue what
There's
I'm doing.
There's this anti-trend as well. So, like, Reddit is almost made to make it as difficult as possible to use.
I don't understand Reddit.
No, no idea.
I've looked at it. I'm
going to do some social media training soon.
Okay.
So Reddit, and then even Private Eye... is like, could you make the text any smaller?
Yeah, well, they're not even online, are they?
They're not online. None of their stuff has headlines on it. Like, what the hell?
Yeah, they're trying to weed out the riffraff, though, aren't they? Isn't that what it is? They want a sophisticated audience. Because there's one author, I can't remember who told me this, an author who'd written a book and the first 30 pages were deliberately incomprehensible. It was, you had to really work at it. And when asked why, he said, because I wanted to keep cunts out of my book.
Wow.
Well, wow. I'm just saying, that might be intellectual snobbery.
Maybe that's just an anecdote, though. Maybe he just...
I had it from a good source.
But is there also a thing of, like, these things, like, Private Eye has been around for a while and has had time to build... Like, I think of the comic Daniel Kitson, who people know in the comedy industry, because he's been going... I can't remember when he got award nominated, like 2001, 2002, and he doesn't ever do any social media or anything. He sells out on the basis of his mailing list, because people know they're only going to see him if they go see him live. But he also started before social media really kicked off. So I don't know... he'd still be as talented, but I don't know if he'd be able to do it as well now.
We've gone back to this, like, be authentic thing, haven't we?
That's the message. Yeah.
Yeah, but then that's what I'm saying is, yourself. Do you still have to... Yeah, like, would it
if you're a penis, be a penis and you might become president.
Quite.
As long as you're authentically shit.
Are you suggesting we're being pro-Trump inadvertently?
I'm playing devil's advocate.
Well handled. Anybody else got a question? Must be one more. Come on, we can do one more, surely. No? Yeah, well done. You're the brave one. What's your name, by the way?
Hi, I'm Lena. So I think that the internet is, like, quite a hateful place, right? So there is this development that I really like at the moment, which is positive news. And I wonder if you, like, personally have experience, and also you guys in drug policy reforming, because it has to be quite solution-driven, if you put out pieces, because I think a lot of the pieces are like, okay, here's the fault, here's the blame, but if you put out pieces and say, this is what we can do to make things better, especially in drug policy reforming, do you get a better resonance with that? Or do you have...
It has to be obvious, easy to grasp within someone's reach. And hopefully they can just do it by sharing the article.
So it couldn't be like a long piece that explains...
No, it can. Of course it can. But like there needs to be an obvious takeaway from it. Discussions don't work very well on the internet. You know, you have to be able to take something away. There has to be like a reason, a purpose. People need to feel satisfied at the end of it.
So, but that means people are going to be more satisfied if they have someone to blame and...
No. They can be satisfied with like a solution as well. I mean, we did an article recently that was like on like five concrete things you could do to help the refugee crisis, and it did very well.
Yeah, okay.
But they have to be like obviously flagged up, written in... It just has to be super clear... Because I think some of these things are often written in a way where people, you know, they don't have enough impact. And people have, it's impact, really, rather than positive or negative. It's like, how much impact can you have?
Yeah, it's sort of allowing people to be helpful because there's so many issues that are too big for people to have any... And that's where I feel a lot of political disillusionment has come from, people going, we can't do anything about this, what's the point? And no one understands us. And so I guess you have to kind of give people something that makes them go, right, I can actually do this, or I can actually get on board with this.
I mean, that's right. And it's using clear language, and it's not talking in jargon, and, it's putting things in, like, sort of sentences. You know, sometimes the BBC does this explainers, and I feel... like I can't understand it, which is not really the point of an explainer because they've gone too chunky.
Sure.
And that kind of rolls back into the previous conversation because what you were saying about, you know, when you put things out there, sometimes you can't call it, can you? You think, as you said, you can tag it all up and do all the right things, but you just don't get the hits. And then there are things you just think, like what you said, Andrew, about the Trump one, you pump it out there and that's the one that gets you the attention. You just can't call it sometimes. It's just whatever it is, you know, the zeitgeist, lap of the gods, whatever it may be. That can be frustrating, can't it?
Yeah.
Damn it.
Damn. The amount of times you spend ages going, I've nailed this joke on Twitter, and then it goes nowhere, and then you put up something with a spelling mistake that isn't funny and it does well, and you go, shit, how has this happened? So unfair.
We're going to wrap up. So, thank you so much, guys, for doing this. Andrew, where can we see you? What are you doing? What's the general picture with Jonathan Pye, you, everything, what's going on?
Well, if I haven't plugged it enough already, which is terrible, there is a tour on Jonathan Pye Tour, which will be early next year, and tickets are on sale now. And we have a book called Jonathan Pye Off the Record, which is out on October the 5th, which is available to pre-order, so please do... I've just come back from the Edinburgh Fringe, so I don't have any stand-up shows coming up for the next month, which I'm really pleased about.
And I saw Jonathan Pye and Andrew in Canterbury, I think it was last year when you was touring, and generally absolutely amazing. Not just saying that because you're there, but as you said, you're a different character in your stand-up to what you are tonight. You know, you said you were quite, you know, trying the boundaries of the room and it was just brilliant. I just really, really enjoyed
it. Oh, yeah, on stage, I'm a complete bitch, yeah. Maybe I have been tonight, I don't know, but yeah.
I wouldn't say so, would you? I don't think Andrew's been a bitch, no. And Tiernan, what can we expect from you? Partly Political Broadcast, what can we do?
That's the podcast, Partly Political Broadcast. Please do sign up and have a listen. I'm doing loads of stuff. The trick is you've got to spell my name to find any of it. So Tiernan Duyeb, D-O-U-I-E-B. I mean, if you throw it into Google, it tends to correct you, which is good. See, Google's all right sometimes. I've got loads of gigs on, loads of other bits. I've got comedy specials on nextupcomedy.com. It's worth a plug because they're brilliant. And I'm relentlessly on Twitter if you want that sort of thing all the time.
And I've gotten good at writing your name, but I still can't pronounce it. So
we're never going to resolve this, are we?
No.
It's an endless problem.
And you said it so quickly then, I didn't hear it again. It's Tiernan...
Duyeb, D-O-U-I-E-B, yeah. See. But the problem is that if I changed it, like people can't get it, but if you Google me, there's only me. So that's probably all right, isn't it? Yeah. I prefer that.
I finally bumped Felicity Morse from Massachusetts, who was arrested for prostitution, onto page 3.
Yes!
Only
excellent
took
work.
7 years.
admittedly, if she hasn't had a hard enough life already, you have just made it worse. But, you know.
No, it wasn't me.
So apart from that, apart from bumping number 3 Google, where can we find you, Felicity?
Message me on Twitter or Facebook, and just Felicity Morse.
And if you listen to the podcast, then if you go to the cast link, all of this will scroll underneath so you can click on them. Can you give a massive round of applause to our 3 guests? Well, again, I was genuinely fascinated by that. I know I say it every time, but I was. I always forget that I took part in a conversation during the editing process and listened to it all over again, which is either I've got a terrible memory or it is a good conversation. I hope it's the latter. So a few thank yous, keep the outro short. Thank you to John, our social media guy. He has been brilliant this year, done so much for us. Thank you to John Harris from the Dream Factory podcast, which is a brilliant podcast in its own right, but also thank you so much for everything you've done for us on the social media front on the Distraction Pieces Network. Thank you so much, John. Also thank you to Nicky the producer, who has poured half of his life into this podcast now. Yeah, we really do spend that much time on it. And Tristan as well. Thank you, Tristan. I'm going to call you Tristan the producer as well, because you spent so much time on this as well. And of course you can find us on social media at UK Leap. That's Instagram and Twitter. You can find us on ukleap.org on Facebook and ukleap.org on the internet. Right. Again, another big thank you to Pablo Diablo from Food to Watch Films by a podcast. Thank you so much again for doing what you did for us, which I mentioned at the start of this. I think that's it. Don't forget, if you want to attend a live show, there are so many that you can. Just keep an eye open on our channels. But also, we get requested to tour this, and we're going to do our best. We're going to try. No promises. But we would like to take it on the road. So, you know, keep your fingers crossed. We'll do what we can. But thank you so much for supporting us and listening and just getting involved. It really does help us out. So thank you, and we'll see you again soon. Bye. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades. Where true values seldom stray.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.